I'm actually not doing the advertised talk. I'd changed my talk, and I guess it was slightly too late to go in the program. So what I want to talk instead is actually about adherence to HIV induction therapy. And I was actually told earlier I didn't need my name badge because my hat was a universal indicator of who I was. So I thought I would wear my hat for this talk. So I want to tell you a little bit about some of the biology of HIV, although we have seen a little bit before. Talk a little bit about drug resistance. Introduce a mathematical model of induction therapy, which is a new type of therapy for HIV. Talk a little bit about impulsive differential equations, for those who don't know, which are a nice mathematical tool that I use. Develop resistance thresholds, calculate the length and number of drug holidays that you can have, and compare with clinical results. Okay, so just a brief sort of summary of HIV. This is a big bad disease. There are many, many people infected. Infection causes depletion of CD4 T cells, primarily. There's no cure, but there are drugs. Right? And what these drugs do is they prolong your life. Right? They don't cure the disease, but you can live with this. And drugs form in a number of major classes. There's reverse transcriptase inhibitors, protease inhibitors, fusion inhibitors, and integrase inhibitors. And I'm going to be thinking about all of these except for protease inhibitors. That's more complex and doesn't quite fall into the same category here. So here's the cartoon of HIV. We have HIV virus infects a cell. And so when it initially infects, here's your HIV, and it initially grabs onto the outside of the cell, and a fusion inhibitor is something that stops the virus fusing onto the cell. Right, so that stops in a very early stage of infection. Then the virus has its RNA, and it has to transcribe that onto DNA. Reverse transcriptase inhibitors stop that reverse transcription, whether they're nucleoside or non-nucleoside. Then the virus has to integrate into the nucleus of the cell, and so there are integrase inhibitors which stop that. And at this point, all the drugs that stop infection are happening before you've started replicating new cells. Right? The last stage is where new virus is formed, and that's where protease inhibitors affect. So what they do is they allow new virus to form, but that new virus is not infectious. Right? So there's something fundamentally different happening between what the protease inhibitors are doing and what the others are doing. So that's why I'm separating the two out. So what I'm thinking about is drugs that stop production of virus. Okay, so the problem of adherence is a big one, and I think Avedon even mentioned this, that we're human beings, right? We take drugs, and I know if, you know, a doctor says to me, take this you know, drug to, you know, just feel better, and you've got to take it for a couple of weeks, I never take the whole course, right? I'm sort of take it for a while, I feel better, and I stop, right? Now, obviously, HIV is more serious, right? It's life-threatening and so on, but still we see that people don't take their drugs, right? The vast majority of people are not 100% adherent, and adherence decreases over time, so you might do it for a while, but then it gets harder and harder. Right? It's a hard thing to do, and the problem is that not taking your drugs has a direct relationship with the development of drug resistance. Right? So it's not just like, oh, well, I missed a few drugs, and you know, what's the harm? There is harm, and what I want to do is develop a model to sort of quantify a bit, see how much harm there can be, and really the question is, can you have a break? And you know, if you missed one dose in your life, does that really matter? Probably not. Right? But if you miss enough doses, it really does matter. So there must be some sort of threshold in here which says, you know what, I can have a small break, but not too long. So I'm thinking specifically about drug holidays. Right? So it's not just sort of you're intermittently taking some and not taking some all of the time. You're a good adherer. You're taking your drugs, and then you have a break. Right? And so you have this break. You have an extended drug holiday, which occurs for a number of reasons. One might be lifestyle factors. You went camping and you forgot your drugs. Right? So you were enforced a couple of days off. Relief from side effects, because HIV drug treatment gives you a lot of side effects. It gives you like vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. It moves your body fat around. You lose the taste for food. There's lots of reasons why you don't want to be on this drugs. And when you stop the drugs, you immediately feel better. Right? So there's a powerful incentive not to take it for a while. There's also economic implications, especially in the developing world. In Africa, or at least in Uganda, I know, they're a triple drug cocktail. There are three drugs. Some are subsidized. So one of the drugs is free. One of the drugs costs $1 a dose. Now, many people live on $1 a day. This is not easily affordable, but nevertheless. The third drug costs $40 a dose. Right? So what you get is you get people take one drug all the time, they take the next drug some of the time, and they take the third drug never. Right? So you're seeing these patterns formed by the economics happening. Right? So you get different adherence effects depending on many, many factors. And this is a poster I found online, and it says you have HIV, people say take your medication, and they have no idea what this is like. Right? It's really, really hard to do this. it's hard to keep taking your drugs. Right? I think you could take up to 26 doses a day. Some you have to take with a meal, some not. This is very, very complicated to do. And as human beings, we struggle. Right? It's very hard to do this. And what tends to happen is if you're doing it in a hospital and nurses coming around and giving you the drugs at the right time, that's easy. If you have a pill reminder that's sort of telling you when to take it, that's okay. And if you're just kind of doing it because you sort of know you should be taking your drugs all the time, then people fall down. So induction therapy is a new type of HIV treatment regime, and the idea is that you take your drugs a lot at first, so you sort of overtake your drugs. The idea is you combat resistance by taking more drugs. There are two phases. One is the induction phase, so it's a period of intense antiretroviral therapy. You might take four drugs, for instance, and you do that for a while, and then you stop, and you now move down to a lower regimen, maybe say two drugs, and this is called the maintenance phase. So that is you sort of hit it hard for a while, then you jump down and it's less intense. And so what I'm going to do is think specifically about the induction phase, but then knowing that once this ends, then there'll be a maintenance phase. And the induction phase has been estimated to last about 6 months, and so that's the baseline I'm going to use. So you're on intense therapy for a while, and then it's going to end. This is different from sort of regular HIV therapy, where you start therapy and then it just goes on for the rest of your life. Right, this is the induction phase is a particular type of therapy with an endpoint, and that endpoint makes a difference. Okay, but the problem is you're taking many more drugs for a while. Right, now, it is a shorter period, so you may be more motivated to take them because you know it's going to end, but on the other hand, people are likely to take some holidays. Right, so we're going to look at this induction phase and really answer the question, how many holidays can you have in this period? Right, one of the issues is because of that endpoint, if you have a holiday at the end, it's like you finished too soon. Right. So, and certainly for some treatments, I know for TB, you've got a fixed amount, and if you end too soon, the treatment doesn't work. So we're going to assume that you need to be at a good place at the end of that 6 months in order to switch over to the maintenance phase. So we don't want to stop too early. So that's one constraint. But maybe we can have some breaks in the middle. Right? So if we can, you know, you miss a dose or a few doses or maybe a few days, or how much can we miss? But if we have a holiday, we assume that we then go back on the drugs. So we take a break for a while, and then it's like we had a weekend and we went camping and partying, and then now we're back to work and we take our drugs again. So you have a break and then you go back on. Okay, so what we'd like to know is, not counting protease inhibitors, how long can we have a drug holiday for? Right, so that's a nice thing to know. Once you've had that holiday, how long do you have to go back on the drugs? And what we'd like to do is return to drug levels from before, but we need to define precisely what we mean by that. And putting that together is, over the 6 month period, how many drug holidays can we have during this phase? Okay, so we're going to assume two strains of the virus. There's our wild type strain, so that's the best fit competitor in the absence of drugs, and then there's the mutant strain, which is, without drugs, a less efficient competitor, but it's more resistant to the drugs. Right. So what you might see is they have some sort of fitness, the better one is the one that's going to dominate, so without drugs, the wild type wins. When drugs come, they affect the wild type more, so it pushes them both down, but it pushes the wild type faster, so then the mutant has an advantage. Right? And now you may have enough drug that pushes them both down, and then it controls both. But there may be a period there where the mutant really has an advantage over the wild type. So that's our basic idea, that the resistant mutants are not completely impervious to the drug, but there's a degree of effectiveness here. Right? So resistance confers a degree of resistance to the drugs. So if you had enough drug in a cell, it might control the mutant, but at intermediate levels, it might be very dangerous. So it sort of gives you two thresholds. You might be fine if you're doing enough drug, or you're fine if you're doing not very much drug, but in the middle, that could be the danger zone. So that's what we want to quantify here. We might have very high levels of drugs for a while, and we're in a nice place, what we're going to call region 3. Then we fall through the intermediate region, which is our bad region, right? And then maybe we fall to the low region, which is not so bad. Right? Now, obviously, you're not having enough treatment in the low region, but it's not causing resistance to emerge either. Right? So in the low region, the wild type has an advantage. In the top region, the drug is controlling both strains, but in the intermediate region, that's where the mutant takes hold. Right? So this is all driven by the amount of drug. As the drug moves between regions, different things are happening. Right? So here are our three regimes. We have region 1 is low. This basically means that the drugs are negligible. They have very little effect on either strain. We have a medium, region 2 is our medium effect, where the drugs are sufficient to inhibit the wild type, but not enough to inhibit the mutant. Right? So this is the danger zone for us because the mutant has a real advantage here because you're controlling the wild type. And then region 3 is our high drug levels where drugs are enough to inhibit both strains. So here are antiviral effect curves. And so you can see sort of as the drug, well, this is on a log scale on the bottom, but as the drug increases, then it controls the drug, it controls the two strains at different rates. And now I'm going to explain later how to get these thresholds, but you can see in region 1, the drug has not much effect on either strain. Now, it does have a little bit of effect, especially up here, but we're going to assume we can figure out that this is basically negligible. Right? So it has basically no effect on either of the drugs here. Then you move into region 2, where it has a big effect on the wild type, but not much effect on the mutant. Right? So this is our danger zone. In region 3, it has now a big effect on both. The effect is different on both, and the effect is different in region 3 than it was in region 2, but nevertheless, we can define our regions being negligible effect, effect on the wild type only, and effect on both. Okay, so that means that in the three regions, in each of the regions, the model is different. All right, so we're going to have three submodels that are connected by drug behavior. Okay, so here is the basic model in region 1. So this is when you have low drug levels, and okay, so you have susceptible cells here, right, and then they can meet a wild-type virus either directly or they get latently infected and then they activate later. But either way, the wild-type infection causes T-cells that are infected with wild-type virus. Right? Or they can meet the mutant and they can either be latently infected first or they can be directly infected, but nevertheless they get infected with the mutant strain. Now, the wild-type has an advantage, so all things being equal, in this case, the wild-type should win. And what we have here is these are cells that are inhibited with drug, and they're dotted because if you have any of these in this region, then they just go away. All right. But let me go to the next region. And the difference here is that now susceptible cells can either meet the wild-type or the mutant, or they can meet the drug. And if they meet the drug, then they become inhibited with drug at an intermediate level. So what that really means is they can be infected by the mutant, either latently or not, but they cannot be infected by the wild-type. So there's no way of one of these cells being infected by the wild-type. So that really gives the mutant an advantage. And in the high levels, then these intermediately inhibited cells get more drug, and so now they have sufficient drug that they can't be infected by either cell so long as they remain in this state. Now, of course, the drug effects can wear off, and if the drug effect wears off, now they're susceptible to infection by the mutant, right, then it may wear off even further, and then they're susceptible to infection by both. Right. So we have a fairly complicated model, and also it's going to change depending where your drug levels are. We need to include these dotted ones because if you started in the high level, then the drug faded. Now all of these guys are just going to fade off because there's not enough new drug coming in, and it may fade again, so that then all the drug cells wear off. So you need to include these, but they don't do a whole lot in that section. Now, talking about the drugs, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that the effect of drugs are instantaneous. All right. So normally you think about the drugs, and they take a little while to get active. Right. You pop your pill, and it's a little while before you have maximum drug available. Right. It has to get into your cells, but it happens pretty quickly. And then what happens is the drugs slowly decay, and they get cleared over this much longer phase, which is quite nicely exponential. That's a pretty good approximation. So you have a very, very fast increase and then a slow decay. And that slow decay is what we care about, right? We don't care about that time to peak. So we're going to assume that's negligible. And what that means is that we still maintain this slow decay, but then we jump instantaneously up when we take a pill. So we say, I pop my pill, and as soon as I pop my pill, I've got a maximum amount of drug. Right? So, and this is an okay approximation, so long as the thing that you're approximating is short compared to the cycle time between. Right? So that's quite true in this case. Right? The time it takes for the body to clear a drug is much, much longer than the time it takes for the pill to get into the cells. If those two things come into phase, you can't use this approximation, but as long as the cycle times are sufficiently large, then this is okay. All right. And this is what we call impulsive differential equations, because it's differential equations that are going to tell us about this nice continuous part, and then an impulse, which is a jump or a shock, telling us how to get from the end of one to the beginning of the next. All right. So it's like we sort of do this very nicely, and then we jump, and it's like we start anew with new initial conditions, and then we let it run again. So that means our model consists of a system of differential equations for the virus and T cells, and then for the drugs, we have a differential equation for the decay part and a difference equation for the impulsive part. So here is the model. I'm not going to go into quite all the details, but it's basically just the equation version of the pictorial form. This is in region one. What I've also included here, though, that I didn't put in the picture is the actual dynamics of the virus. The virus is produced at some rate proportional to the number of infected cells, whether they're mutants or wild type. The virus decays at some rate. It's lost due to infection, either of the wild type or the mutant, which can affect different cells. There's non-infectious virus, which actually decouples from the system, so it plays no part. The only thing I really want to point out here is if you look at the cells inhibited with drug, the cells inhibited with high levels of drug, if there are ever any, then they just exponentially decay. Right? They either die at the same rate as uninfected cells, or they are lost. When they're lost, they move into intermediately inhibited cells. That's the only way into there. Every other term is negative, so they will also decay very quickly. So if there are any cells inhibited with drugs, they just disappear from the system. So as we move to the next region, now what happens is susceptible cells, right? So they were created at some constant rate. They're lost due to infection. They're lost due to death. They appear if any drug wears off. Now they're lost if they meet some drug. And so susceptible cells that meet drug now become intermediately inhibited cells, right? And so there's a way into this one here that's not just a trivial way from wearing off of the supercells. So that means now we have intermediately inhibited cells, and the danger zone is that these can be infected by the mutant, right? Not the wild type, but only the mutant. And now if we go into the third region, if you were paying attention, this rate constant changed because the infection rate is different, but the form is the same. And now we have another case, which is that the intermediately inhibited cells may meet more drug, and if they meet more drug, now there's a way into the last cell, and that last cell is the supercell. There's no way of infecting the cell while it remains in this case. So it may die, or more likely the drug wears off. If the drug wears off, now it's intermediately inhibited, can be infected by the wild, infected by the mutant, then it can wear off and it becomes back to susceptible, and then it can be infected by the wild type, as well as the mutant. Okay, so the model for drugs is much, much simpler. We just have exponential decay so long as we're not at one of the times where we take a pill, right? These TKs are the times at which we pop our pills. Otherwise, it's just nice exponential decay. And when you do take a pill, well, if you take one, then you go up by a constant amount because the amount of drug in each pill is the same. And if you didn't take one, then nothing happens. You would just then continue to decay exponentially. So it's very, very simple, and very nicely, it's solvable. We solve it piecemeal because we solve within each one, and then we jump across to the next one, we solve that, and so on. But it's quite, quite simple. It means we have a complete understanding of what the drugs are doing, which we then feed back into the other model, which obviously we can't solve. It's too complicated, but it gives us some way of getting a hold of what's happening. So this is the solution of the drugs, and so you can see each time we pop a pill, then it decays, right, but not to zero. We pop a pill, it decays, and so on. And in fact, not only is it solvable, but the endpoints converge monotonically to the endpoints of a periodic orbit that's an impulsive periodic orbit, because it's got a jump in it. But it's only got one jump, so eventually there's some periodic orbit which decays, jumps back up to the same point, and it's nice and stable, and everything looks really nice. Right. So, and we just denote the endpoints before an impulse, it has a minus, and immediately after the impulse, has a plus. Okay, so now we may take a drug holiday, right, and we'd like to know how long can we have off. Well, let's suppose we took drugs for a while, right, we're doing pretty well, then we take a holiday, and we decrease down. What we don't want to do is go into region 2, right, because region 2 is where the mutant has an advantage. Right. So we're going to avoid region 2. If the region 2 threshold is there, we'll say, well, we can miss as many doses as we like, so long as you don't get into region 2 at all. And once we do that, we'll then take some more doses until we get back up to the periodic orbit. Now, of course, it takes an infinitely long time to get to the periodic orbit, so we can't precisely get to it, but we can get arbitrarily close. All right. So what this means is we solve, because we can solve explicitly, solve the drugs up to here, and then you can then solve for how long it takes you to miss some drugs. Then you can solve using those initial conditions, which depended on these conditions, how many drugs should you take next, and then you rinse and repeat. Okay, so let me come back to how do we determine those thresholds? And using the antiviral effect curves, looking at R1 versus R2, so the region 1 versus region 2 threshold, there's basically a factor N here, which is sort of the degree of resistance caused by the mutant. Right, so for a tenfold resistance, you need 10 times as much drug to have the same effect. And when you collapse this down, then it means that R1 is 1 over N R2. Right, so if we know R2, we would find R1 quite easily. So the question is, how do we determine R2? Right. So what we have here is, aside from the impulsive part, these are deterministic differential equations, so we're not creating new mutant at any time. the way to put the mutant into here is to start with an initial condition that has mutant. So we're going to say initially there's some mutant amount of virus, but also initially it's very easy to show that it's decreasing. So that there is some mutant and it starts to decrease. Now, if something is initially decreasing, two things will happen. Either it will continue to decrease forever, or it will reach a minimum and start to increase. Right. So there's some time T star at which it reaches the minimum, assuming it doesn't decrease. Well, it's not going to decrease indefinitely, because if it did, we wouldn't have any problems. If it does decrease indefinitely, we can define T star arbitrarily. But assuming that it doesn't, we reach a nice minimum here. Right, so the virus has gone down, hit a minimum. Right, and that's that value of drug at which that occurs is what we're going to define to be R2. Right, so we're actually being a little over conservative here. What we want to make sure is that the virus was only decreasing before we hit R2. So if we start in the high drug level region, then everything is good. We're not going to have any development of resistance, or at least any increase in resistance before we reach R2. Right, so we reach R2 when resistance stops decreasing and starts increasing. Right, so this just makes sure that we're actually quite tight in terms of our R2. There might be a better definition of R2 that gives us more wiggle room, but this one really ensures that we're not going to have an increase. And I'll show later that we do see some effect of that. We are a little bit more conservative than we need to, but I think that's fine. Okay, so there's one more condition, which is, well, actually there's sort of two more conditions, but I'm going to make them the same, which is this one here. Is what we want to do is we say, okay, we take drugs for a while, right? Then we take a drug holiday, and then we're going to take some more drugs. And over our entire six-month induction period, what's the average amount of drug? So we can easily determine that. And what we're going to add, though, is a condition which says that the average amount of drug should be higher than the trough value if you didn't have any holidays. Right? So if you took no holidays, the trough value is approximately there. And we say we want the average to be bigger than that. We don't want the average to slip below that, because although R2 is the danger zone, there are some problems if you're sufficiently low in R3, in region 3. So we're just going to keep things high enough, which means that, what does that mean? It means you have to take enough doses after a holiday. Right? Now, that also gets into how many doses do we need to take to get close enough to the periodic orbit. We want to be close. How did we define close? Well, we can define it to be arbitrarily close, but we're going to use this condition to get our arbitrary closeness. So we say we want, on average, things to not be any worse than the worst-case scenario if we didn't take any holidays at all. Right? So that's the one we want. Okay, so now let's put it all together. And what do we need to find? First, we need to find, you start from no drugs at all. You need to take a bunch of drugs in order to get good enough, close enough to the periodic orbit, right, before you take a holiday. Right, you can't take a holiday on day one. You can't take it on day two, but maybe you can take it on day 10. So we take some drugs for a while. Right, that's N1. Then we take a drug holiday. Right, we have a condition to know how long we can take it for. So we need to find out how long we want to do that for. Right, that's H1. Then we need to know how many doses you take after the holiday, and it may be different from the first one, because the first one we were definitely starting at zero, and now we're not starting at zero. Right? So there is a difference here, but as it turns out, the difference is pretty slight. And then we take the next holiday and the next subsequent drugs and so on, keep doing this, and at the end, right, we need to know how many drugs to take so that you're back up to the periodic orbit at the end. Right? So we have in between here, we have a whole bunch of holidays and subsequent therapy happening over and over again. We have to worry about the first lot and also the last lot in addition to that. Okay, so we want to be within epsilon of periodic orbit, or at least epsilon 1 at first. And to do this, because we can solve this, right, we start from 0, we solve, and we get up to say, okay, I want to be, this bottom level here has to be close enough to a periodic orbit. I can find this formula for the number of doses that I need to take. It needs to be at least this many. And what this involves is, it involves the decay rate of the drugs, right, which I know from pharmacokinetic data, the period that you're supposed to take the drugs of, which I know, right, it's once, twice, or three times a day, the amount of drug you take per pill, and this epsilon, this threshold. Right, and I'm going to determine that from the previous condition, which is that I want the average to be high enough. So this all involves things that are very, very well known. Right. So, and epsilon 1, you can choose to be like 0.01 or something. You keep it very small. It doesn't matter too much. It can be 1% of the periodic orbit. Whatever sort of arbitrary tolerance you want, our additional condition gives us a nice way of making sure we're in. And this gives us a nice sort of way of getting close enough to the periodic orbit. Okay, so having taken a bunch of drugs, now we have a drug holiday. And we'd like to say, okay, we'll take a holiday and we'll be no worse than R2. Right? So then we solve for H1, right? And again, this involves the decay rate of the drug, the period of the drug, the dose of the drug, and R2, which we solved from before, right? And that we can determine for H1, as well as the number of doses you'd already taken from the first phase. But again, this is just a relatively simple formula involving things that we know. Right? So now, having missed a bunch of doses, right, we're now going to take a bunch, and how many do we need to take? We're going to be within epsilon 2 of the periodic orbit, and this is, again, involving all the things we already know. Right? So these formulas are not too complicated, they involve things we know, and they're relatively easy to write down. Right? So let's assume that the epsilons are all the same, so that you're within the same amount of the periodic orbit each time. If that's true, then it means the length of each drug holiday is the same. Right? This is kind of what we expect, but we did it generally first. Right? In that case, all the subsequent doses, including the last one, are the same, right? Because the last one really says, I'm up to here, and there may be a few more, but that's the minimum number you need. Right? They're all the same. The first one might be different. That's because the first one started at zero. As it turns out, it's not too different. It's maybe different by one dose. Right? So that means things are quite nice. And these are relatively straightforward formulas, right? I can give this to somebody who's not an expert in math, and they can see this formula and they can apply it. Right? So let's look at this for all the drugs. It's not quite all the drugs. These are drugs that are involved in approved combinations. Right? So what we have for each one, and this data is very easily available online, we have the dosage of each drug. We have the dosing interval. You take it once, twice, or three times a day. The half-life, which by very simple formula turns into the decay rate. The region 1 threshold we can calculate, and the region 2 threshold we can calculate. And then maximum number of missable days, right, so we streamlined everything to be days. Right, this is how many days you can have off in a drug holiday, and then here's how many days you have to have on again. And these are actually quite reasonable numbers, right? So you know, for abacavir, you could have 3 days off, and you have to have 7 days back on. For a really nice one like tenofovir, you can have 10 days off, and you have 24 days on. But you can sort of see this kind of ratio is relatively similar across the things. You have a while off, and then you have to be good for a much longer time. Right? Some are quite short. You can have less than 2 days off, but then you don't have to go on for very long to get back up. So the numbers, of course, vary a lot depending on the drug, but we can easily calculate these. And we also have a general method. We can do it for new drugs that come along, right, that don't work like protease inhibitors, but new drugs that work in a similar way to these drugs. So, for example, if you're taking a cocktail, and this cocktail involves FTC, DDI, and EFV, then we can just calculate for each one. For FTC, you can have 6 days off, 17 on. For DDI, you have 5 days off, 7.5 days on. And for EFV, 9 days off, 22 on. Right? Then DDI here is the first drug to reach 2. Right? So if there's going to be a mutation, it's going to occur to DDI first. Right? So we'll use that as our threshold. Now, really, our results were derived from monotherapy, but the monotherapy is protected by the other drugs. So it's not going to be as bad as this in reality. This is sort of the worst case scenario if you had no other drugs protecting against mutation. But we can use DDI as our limit here. And so that means that during our 180-day period, right, then we can figure out how many holidays we can have because, let me put the next line on, it turns out that the first one is going to be the same. We need to go on for 7.5 days. Then we can have a 5-day holiday, go back on for 7.5 days, do that 13 times, then have our final 7.5 days, that adds up to 177.5, right, which is less than 180. So that's how we derive the 13, because if you make that 14, it's bigger than 180. So it tells you how many drug holidays you can have in here, because you go on, you go off, you go on again, and then you repeat the off and the on many, many times, and at the end you go back on. Right, so the many, many times we can figure out nicely here. So let's have a look. Here is for abacavir. And this is if you do what we prescribe, right? You take the prescribed drug holidays, and you can see here we have wild type and we have mutant. They're both mostly decayed. There's a little bit of a bump here. And over time, things are quite nice. Right? You can see this is sort of 10 to the minus 3 in terms of the mutant. So this is not emerged. These are the healthy cells at the end. And so this is pretty good. Right? I would be quite happy with that. If you miss one more dose per holiday, right, then this jumps from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the 4. Right, you have huge oscillations in the mutant by just missing one more dose. Right? So the wild type is controlled, the mutant is not. The mutant emerges and it remains high. Right, so results are similar for 3TC. Right, again, if you follow our prescription. Again, you get a lot of healthy cells. You're looking at very small numbers of mutation. It decreases down. And if you miss one more dose per holiday, then you're looking at 10 to the 4 and huge oscillations in the mutant. So every time you're taking a break, your break is too long. You have a small period there where you're in region 2. That's causing a massive replication of the mutant. The mutant has a real advantage. Once you've got it, it's very hard to get rid of it again. So you're sort of stuck in this cycle. For D4T, so here's a drug that obviously you shouldn't take for monotherapy because it's not controlling the wild type, but nevertheless, it would be controlling the mutant in theory. But then if you miss more than one, you miss one extra dose per holiday, it's a slight increase in the wild type, but it's a huge increase in the mutant. Right? So again, we're seeing a jump from sort of minus 3, 10 to the minus 3, to 10 to the 3. Right? Oh, and also very low, like if you're doing it sort of as we prescribe, you're still having fairly low numbers of healthy cells, but if you miss one extra dose, you're having much, much lower numbers of healthy cells. Similar results for FTC. Again, you're having these huge changes. For ZWDN, again, you don't want to be taking this as monotherapy, but we knew that already because that failed very badly in the early stages. You miss one extra dose per holiday, things are very bad. Same with bidenosine. And the one interesting one here is navarapine, where, so again, you just take the prescribed drug holidays. You're having some time off, all right? You know, you have a large number of healthy cells at the end, all right? And if you missed one extra dose, it's actually pretty similar to this. If you mix two extra doses, it's similar to this. And you need to miss three extra doses to have an outbreak of high mutation. All right, so this one, it looks the same, but the difference is that you have three extra doses per drug holiday. And that's what we're seeing here is our over-conservativeness in driving R2 means that we didn't really enter the bad region because we were too conservative about putting R2. So you'd have to miss more than just one dose. So what that means is our results are not sharp, but they're erring on the conservative side. Right, so here, if you took an extra dose off, it's not so bad, but that's probably still not a good idea. Okay, so what this means is we can look at all the combinations of non-protease involving drugs. Right, so there's a fair few of them, and a lot of those are now being rolled out in developing countries. And for each of these, you can derive the number of drug holidays you can have in the induction phase, the length of each holiday, and the minimum subsequent therapy. Right. And the asterisk here just denotes which drug reaches R2 first. Right. So the results are, quite variable. Some are very short, some are very long, depending. But at least we can get some idea. Okay. So lastly, what I'm going to do is just compare some of these results with some clinical results, and look at some different things that have been done with treatment interruptions. So a number of trials were done looking at taking breaks, and initially they looked at very long interruptions. Right. There was the SMART trial, which concluded in very early 2006, which had 16-month interruptions, so very, very long interruptions. And there was a lot of excitement about this at the time. They really thought this would be great. A similar trial, the DART trial, that had 12-week interruptions. And these didn't really work. Right. But not only did they not work, the SMART trial, in fact, had to be halted prematurely because too many people were dying. And this was a big, big shock to people at the time. They were not expecting this at all. And so this caused a big upset in a lot of thinking. These long interruptions, I mean, you would like to have a long time off. Right? That would be nice. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's possible. There was a twofold risk of developing AIDS or death for treatment interruptions that were greater than 3 months. So a lot of study was done on the results they did have afterwards to try and determine what was going on. And so it looks like that long treatment interruptions, sadly, do not appear viable. Like you don't get months off. Right? You get a shorter time. Right. So if we look at some shorter times, then studies have been done with sort of 2 to 6 week breaks. These observe no benefits, but they observe no increase in viral resistance either. Right. So a sort of intermediate break of the order of weeks was not seeing great benefits, but it wasn't seeing the worst outcomes. Right. And very short interruptions, less than a week, these resulted in much better outcomes, only 5% of participants increasing their HIV counts. Right. So short breaks appear to be tolerable. And what I want to do is look specifically at what's called FOTO, so 5 on, 2 off. This is you take your drugs for 5 days, you have 2 days off. All right, so it's like you take your drugs during the week, you have weekend free. So they did a pilot study on this, a couple of pilot studies actually, I think. We did have some discussions with them early on, but then we weren't involved beyond that. This is some of our earlier modeling was guiding some of the plans they were doing. This achieved virologic suppression in 89.6% of patients, all right, which is pretty good. And remember, this is every week you're having 2 days off. Right? You're having a lot of breaks. You're just not having them for very long. What's more, people liked this, right? There was excellent adherence to this. People really followed it. They also really they enjoyed it in a sense. Well, nobody loves it, but they did a little survey and they sort of said, on a 10-point scale, how do you like this? And I think the average was 9.7. People said, this is fine. You know, I can take my drugs for 5 days knowing I have the weekend off. I can look forward to Friday. You know, thank God it's Friday. I have my drugs off. You know, I can party. I can relax. They did it for teenagers. Teenagers were fine taking it during the week. They just couldn't take it on the weekends because they were out with their friends. They were, you know, partying. They were doing things. Sometimes they were hiding the fact they're infected and so on. This sort of seemed to fit in with people's lifestyles pretty well. It didn't always work, but where it didn't work, which is interesting, I only found this out after I'd finished the theoretical modeling, was these were the three drugs in combinations where it failed, and amazingly, these are the three for which we predicted that you have less than 2 days leeway. Right? So if you're having your 2 days of the weekends off, right, these combinations that included these three drugs, those are the ones that failed, and they were the only ones that failed. Right? And that precisely matches our theoretical results. Right. And everything else maintained 100% virologic suppression. Right. So it looks like something is going on with these drugs, and that's that you can't have 2 days off, you can have less time off. Right. So the results here very strongly correlated with our predictions, which is really nice. Okay, so let me summarize. Inductive therapy is different to previous therapy because it has an endpoint. Right. You take it for a while, and then you have to stop, and at the end, you want to be in a good place. Right. So there are challenges to adherence here. We're taking more pills, so people are less likely to be taking all the drugs, but they're only taking it for a finite time, so that makes a difference. I think one of the key lessons that sort of people are just starting to learn is that treatment interruptions need to be considered on a drug-specific basis. This may seem obvious, but this has not been the way it's been thought. It's sort of been like, just take some time off. But actually, we need to think about what drugs are you on. The amount of time you have off does depend on which drugs that you're on. And so we can determine the length and number of drug holidays for all the FDA-approved combinations that do not involve protease inhibitors. Right, now, a lot of them do involve protease inhibitors, but we can certainly do it for the ones that don't. We can figure out how long you can have off, how many doses you have to take afterwards. And this 5-on-2 off therapy is extremely promising and nicely in line with our predictions. So to conclude, induction therapy is okay if you can have some breaks in the middle, so long as you do them just so. Right, the outcome depends on the specific drug cocktail. Right. And if you have a break, then you can have one, but it has to be short, and then you have to take a very strict regime afterwards. Right. So it's not like you can't do intermittent, sort of, you know, oh, I took it every other day or something. You can have your break, but it's very defined. Right. And this 5-on-2-off therapy is acceptable for all PI sparing cocktails except those containing these three drugs. Right. Three of the drugs raise red flags, both in the clinical results and in our modeling, and these can tolerate shorter than 2 days off. But we can maybe adjust the therapy for those drugs. And I just want to acknowledge my PhD student, Rochelle Moran. Here are the two references. This is the main reference in BMC infectious diseases, but I also put up here the early modeling that we did looking at adherence when there wasn't an endpoint. That was non-ending adherence. Okay, so thank you very much.